Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld. And this program is about the evolution of consciousness, how we are evolving a new paradigm for looking at the mind, our behaviors, our process of evolution as a cultural, social species. And that's to do with our understanding of our own psychology, our own mind. So as part of the series I've been doing on that for the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy, this is another one of the members of that organization, Anne-Marie Augusta. Welcome to the program, Anne-Marie.
Hello.
Hey,
yes,
how are
you? Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Good, good. Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Well, yeah. You know what I like about your approach to spirituality and psychotherapy is that it comes from, in a way, an ancient tradition, and the Sufi tradition. Can you know, I saw you give a great presentation about that. Can you review some of that process, like what it is to be a Sufi, and then how maybe you apply that to psychology? But first, let's talk about, what are Sufis?
Sufis. So, yeah, a Sufi is a practitioner of the ancient mystical aspect of Islam called Sufism. But a Sufi is actually somebody who's attained the highest levels of enlightenment on that path. So there are actually very few Sufis. Usually, somebody who's embarked on the path of Sufism, who's a student, is called either a dervish or a murid. So we're all students, right? So I'm considered a dervish, and people from different Sufi orders are called different things. But really, a Sufi is somebody who's attained a very high level of enlightenment in the mystical path of Islam, kind of the esoteric inner core.
How long have you been a Sufi? I mean, in this order, like this path.
Well, I've been following the path. I took hands, where I became initiated, about 6 years ago, in the Nur Ashki Jarahi lineage, and my teacher is Sheikha Fariha Al Jarahi, and so in a formal sense, I've been a dervish for about 6 years. But you know, there's a saying that somebody is actually born a dervish. You know that your soul actually comes into this world already on the path. So,
but what was it about that path that you really liked that made you, you know, want to become a dervish?
You know, the path itself is known as the path of love. And love is something that I've been seeking and following my entire life in different forms and manifestations. So, you know, in one sense, I guess the Sufi path is the path of love, in that most of the teachings, the poetry, the intimacy with God is at the core of everything. In another sense, that love is at the core of every single spiritual tradition that exists. So the reason why, I mean, there's not really an outward reason why I followed this path. It kind of found me. You know, my teacher came out to the seminary where I was a student at the time, and when she came out and performed the zikr, which is the Sufi service of remembrance, something moved inside of me, and I was drawn to her, and I was drawn to the path, and it's just been that way ever since. But it's not like there's a particular teaching or a particular thing about this path that is, I think, more truthful or better than any other path. It's just that this was the path that was meant for me.
Right. But, you know, people do, well, can mix up Sufism with Islam. And can you talk about, you know, I mean, Sufis or people of a Sufi order are Islamic, and, you know, they're getting a bad rap these days. So,
right.
So talk about that just a little bit, if you don't mind.
Sure, sure. Yeah, you know, it's said that, you know, some people say the first Sufi was Adam. Some people say the first Sufi was Muhammad, and yet Sufism does have its roots in Islam. However, it's kind of a deeper understanding of what Islam truly is. You know, Islam, when you look beyond the surface level, when you're able to read the Quran from your heart, you see in those pages what's reflected there from your own heart. So Islam is really about love. The Prophet Muhammad, he was preaching a path of love. And if you read the Quran with love in your heart and with the intention of peace and with the intention of bringing that love and bringing that conciliatory nature to the world, that's what you find. But like all scripture, if you look there for a reason to bring war and to bring hatred and to bring strife, you can find reasons for it there too. It's just like the Old Testament, just like the Bhagavad Gita, you know. You can find justification for just about anything, anywhere you look. But the Quran and Islam is founded on the tenets of peace. I mean, Islam means to surrender. And
why has it gotten such a bad rap these days? I mean,
I think it's gotten such a bad rap because people are confusing culture with religion and
right.
spirituality. You know,
right.
There are many cultures that have they're cultures of war, but that doesn't. You find those cultures among all the different religious traditions. You know,
right.
It's
very easy to read into what we're saying.
You know, it's easy to kind of read something literally and on surface level and to use it as a justification to bring war and a justification to feel superior to other cultures or to other human beings. You know, but if you have the right intention and the right motivation, then you can see more deeply into whatever the tradition has to offer. And then you see that all the traditions are about one thing and one thing alone, and that's how to live together in peace and in love. And if any tradition is used to any other means other than that, then it's not a true tradition, you know, or you're reading into it wrong.
So you're saying these warlike cultures, and not to get too political because I really am not interested, but the people who are warlike have used the Quran, Islam, as an excuse to make war, where really it's about peace.
Absolutely.
Okay. And the treatment of women, you know, how?
So in the Quran, you know, Muhammad was actually a feminist, and people don't realize this. You know, if you look at the context of the times that he lived in, he was the first one to give, maybe not the first, one of the first, to give women the right to inherit property. Before he came, women were treated as chattel. They either lived or died at the whim of the men who owned them. And when he came along, he instituted rules that said, no, a woman is entitled to receive property. A woman is entitled to divorce her husband. This was unheard of before he came along. In his time, if a family gave birth to a female child, it was seen as such a disgrace that it was a common practice to bury that infant girl alive.
And well, it might still be then. Not maybe a common practice, but I'm sure that still happens. I mean,
all kinds of crazy, horrible things happen in this world, things that go against the very nature of the human heart, and that's what he came to speak out against, you know, and those kinds of things do not have a basis in religion. They have a basis in human limitation and in the baser aspects of the human being. And the prophets and the saints and the sages and the people that came to serve humanity came to elevate us from that, to elevate the human soul and the human race from those baser aspects. You know, so sure, well, I'm sure those things probably do still go on. You know, and that's exactly why these sacred traditions came about.
Well, you are a person of love, so I mean,
inshallah,
I guess this just speaks.
We all are, inshallah. You know, we come into this place, and you know, we've got to pull off those veils from it.
We've got to pull off our what? You said
the veils. So it's kind of like, you know, we come in. We're all beings of love, every single one of us, at our core. But when we come into the world, you know, there's a saying that says the Sufi belief is that you come in, the soul is this perfect core of divine light and love, and then it passes through the elements, and it passes through the earth, and it passes through the water first, and it becomes wet, and then it passes through the earth, and it becomes like a little statue, and then it passes through the fire, and it becomes like baked clay, and by the time we actually get to the earth, we're these beautiful souls of light and love encapsulated in these bodies, you know, and the bodies are kind of like a veil, but we need them to survive in the world. But at our core, you know, every single one of us is the same, and we're all love.
Right, but a lot of people have forgotten. I mean, look at all the awful wars that are going on in the world at this time.
And so we all forget, you know. I forget, you know. We all forget in different ways. From the moment that you open your eyes or close your eyes, it's part of the nature of being a human being to forget. But the Sufi way is the way of remembrance. So Zikrullah means to remember God with every breath. So every breath is an opportunity to remember that you are love, that we're love, and that we are God. You know, and every moment is an opportunity to manifest God in our everyday existence. The way to do that is to bring that intention and to remember who we are, and all we are is a vessel for that divine energy that we call Allah. That's all we are.
I guess one of the most famous Sufis was Rumi, right? Because he talks all about that.
Yeah. I was just reading him before you called.
What were you reading? Can you tell me which piece?
Yeah, I just read this beautiful, I'm going to take it out, this beautiful, so I have these set of cards, and often I use them in my practice with my clients.
Yeah, I want to get to your practice, but yeah, let's hear the Rumi stuff.
Yeah, so I use cards in my practice a lot in a way to kind of bring a focus. So, you know, people are, you know, when people are in the session or struggling or something, I'll pull a deck of cards and, you know, ask them to ask for inner guidance or be centered or something, and then pull a card from a particular deck. And I have a deck with Rumi, a Rumi deck, and I just pulled a card before you called me. And the card says...
Oh, good. What card did you pull? That's good.
The card says, "Hold me in the fire, and although I die, I know for whom and why."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Sufis say you have to die before you die. I mean, you know, this whole thing about surrendering the ego and burning, and that's sort of part of the language of Rumi, right?
Yeah, very much so. And it's also a language of therapy. Because
that's true. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. When you,
so
when
then,
you speak,
what were you saying? What?
I was saying when a client comes to therapy, you know, usually they come because they're looking for a way to escape the fire, you know.
Right.
Whether it's the fire of despair or the fire of anxiety or, you know, the fire of change, you know, resisting change. So people come in to therapy looking for a way out, you know, but what you don't realize is that there is no way out. There's only a way through, you know. And
so,
the way I...
Yeah, talk about then, you know, you were a therapist before you became part of the Sufi order?
Yes. Oh. Yeah, I've been a therapist. Well, I've been in social work since I was 19, actually. So I've been in a lot of different areas of social services, and that's been that's been a core part of who I am, you know, of
well, so how did your social service work change once you started to study this spiritual tradition?
It changed, I think, because, well, for a number of reasons. When I became a dervish and embarked on this path, I slowly accepted this idea that life, my life wasn't something to be changed or tolerated or figured out, you know. It was just kind of something to open to. And that that's kind of what I try to help my clients see, you know, that it's not about figuring out what's wrong. You know, it's not about fixing something. You know, everything is already as it should be. It always is. It's about trusting more. It's about opening more, you know. Mm-hmm. It's about understanding that each one of us is on a path already, and that there's nothing necessarily that, you know, we're doing wrong or that we're doing right. It's just about, you know, opening and trusting in that process. So in my own life, when I became a dervish, I started to, through life experiences. So what happens when you become part of a mystical community is that the minute that you say yes, it's like that scene in The Matrix, you know? You know that movie, The Matrix?
Yes, that's a classic. Yeah. Yes. Yes,
right,
yes.
So there's that scene where, I guess his name is Neo, is asked, you know, which pill do you want, the red pill or the blue one? And it's kind of like, you know, he chooses the one that wakes him up. And the minute that he does that, all this stuff starts to happen, right? So that's kind of like what my experience was. And I think a lot of people's experience is that the moment that you choose to say yes, things come up in your life that are meant to come up so that you can learn from them. So when that started happening with me, I started to understand and see that that my life is about surrendering to that and trying to not control it to what I think it should be. So as I started to go through those experiences, I developed, you know, inshallah, and still developing a way to find peace with it, you know, and to allow that to happen, allow to continually surrender to the process of life rather than trying to conquer it, you know. And well, that completely shifted how I did therapy.
I mean, that makes sense to me. But let's say practically someone comes into you. Actually, I had a friend who just committed suicide, and he was very depressed. I didn't really know how to reach him. He was into all the stuff, and he was a loving guy. You know, he's just a beautiful guy, but he couldn't get through. I'm not saying you don't have the answers, but how does that approach help someone with a really practical problem? You know what I mean?
Yeah. So it's, you know, this is, of course, everybody has different needs. Every client is different, you know, and not every single person who comes into my office will be suited to this, you know. For some people, this is just not for them, you know. They have, you know, different needs, and, you know, somebody who is chronically suicidal might not be at a point where, you know, they can hear this kind of stuff. They might need something different. And that's
just in general, how do you work with you know, someone in a, you know, some classical I mean, how do you, so you don't introduce, you say you don't introduce people to, you kind of see where they're at. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really about where the person is at. And it's not like, you know, I would sit down and you know, open up the Quran. You know, it's kind of like, it's really, because really, it's, everyone has their own path to what this truth. These truths are universal, and you can find them in scriptures, you can find them in philosophies, you can find them in art, you can find them in music, and everybody's path is different, but yet they all lead to the same place. So knowing inside of oneself where that peace is, you know, somebody else doesn't have to travel the same road that I do in order to resonate with that peace. You know, it's that being anchored in that truth that helps other people find theirs. You know, because that truth is something that goes beyond words or beyond dogmas. So It's about, really, if I have someone coming into my office who, you know, is, I've been having a lot of people come into my office who are atheists. And and we talk about, you know, what is it that you hold on to during those times when you do feel like, wow, I just wish I wouldn't get up tomorrow. You know, the times that feel like, you know, it would be a lot easier to stay buried under the covers and never to venture out again. What is it that gets you through those times? Because whatever that is, it's the same thing that I call Allah, only we don't have to call it by the same name. As long as you can plug into that and anchor in that, and somehow we can find your way there, that's all that anyone can ever hope for, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But for somebody...
No, what were you going to say?
For somebody who is not comfortable with seeking that in religion or in spirituality, well, spirituality is very different from religion anyway. But for somebody who's not comfortable seeking that in any kind of an organized system, that's fine, as long as you find it somewhere.
If spirituality is different than religion, where does Sufism fit in that?
Sufism is very much about spirituality. Sufism is about direct experience of God, direct experience of the divine. And that
How?
Is spirituality.
How do we have that direct experience?
How? By living it, and by showing up for it every day.
But everyone's doing that, aren't they? Everyone's living it?
By living it with your eyes, I think, open to it. Granted, this is not saying that every Sufi does this, but not every dervish does this. As a matter of fact, very few of us, I think, are able to. But it's something that we aspire to. To kind of live every single moment of our life with our eyes open to that, you know, open to that divinity, open to that truth.
But how actually, I'm just like, how do you do it? I guess that's what I'm asking. How do you live every moment?
I try to do it by being conscious at every moment, that I'm able to, every moment that comes into my awareness, that this moment is sacred, and what is transpiring in this moment needs to be free from my judgment, you know. So I try not to judge the moment. I try to open up to it, and there are plenty of painful moments, you know, where it's difficult to do that. But the pain serves as a flag for me, you know. To remember. The pain helps me to remember. So does the joy. You know, to remember that I'm just a vessel for the divine, and to call me back to that awareness that everything that I think is really happening, that everything is really just a manifestation of, you know, they say God's play. You know, this is all God's play. And I can engage in it and open to it and let it cook me and let it prepare me, or I can resist it, and that's where suffering comes. So how do I do it? is that what how I do it is by
yeah.
simply reminding myself or allowing myself to be reminded in every moment that it comes to my mind that I am not separate from that one reality. You know. So is that am I being
Yeah, no, you're being really clear and very sensitive and very tuned in. And, you know, you do. I know the head of the order was Noor, Lex Hickson, you know.
And his voice is coming up in his,
What's that? You say what?
On November 1st is the anniversary of his passing. He passed on November 1st, 1995.
Right.
So this will be the, 95?
I did zikr with him. He would throw people into the zikr. He'd just pick them up and throw them in there. And but before that, I mean, actually, I'm doing this show in a way because I was influenced by him. He used to do a program on WBAI talking about this called In the Spirit. Did you ever hear that?
Yes, of course. Oh, yes, mashallah.
He was also a Christian. He was an expert on the life of Ramakrishna. He was pretty amazing. I mean, people would say all over the place, but they were all had this common mystical theme, you know.
He was such a light, such an amazing
being. I brought him up because in a way that you're talking, you know, where. You're not saying this is how it is. You're saying this is your. It reminded me of how he would talk on in the spirit. You know.
Thank you.
Yeah, he would say that, and in a very thoughtful manner, he would start. He would speak. You know, he would. Yeah, it was very. You know, without trying to form an opinion, but very unjudgmental. But, you know, it's really fascinating to listen to. So I'm just saying something is in that order as a part of you. I can feel that.
Oh, well, thank you very much. That's kind of, my greatest desire, really, because his spirit, the spirit of Sheikh Noor, Lex Hickson, the spirit of Muzaffar Effendi, who was Sheikh Noor's teacher, and the spirit of Sheikh Afariha, who's Sheikh Noor's successor, it's all kind of the same light. And we dervishes who have been so, so, so blessed to be able to be initiated in this lineage, inshallah, we all, you know, become absorbed in that light. So to hear that from you is such a beautiful, beautiful gift and affirmation of his presence. Thank you so much.
Well, it just came to me. But I wanted to ask you, though, because you said you were a therapist before you got into this order. How did your approach change to people? I mean, what was the transformation in you and your therapy as you took on the spiritual tradition?
Before I became a dervish, I was trained in school and in the different trainings and such that therapists go through. That you know, the therapist is the expert. You know, the therapist is the one who helps the client to heal. So a client comes to you and you kind of pull out your bag of tricks and okay, well, let's use some CBT for this person and some psychodynamic stuff for this person or maybe some EMDR here. And it's kind of like, you know, you get the sense that
that's what
you're
people
the,
do, yeah.
Yeah, but really once I embarked on this path, I started to realize that the healing really has nothing to do with me at all. I'm just kind of a vessel maybe or a conduit. The healing is something that comes from far beyond myself, you know, what I knew.
You always knew that, though. Did you always know that, usually?
I always knew it in a sense, but in a much more tangible way. once I became a dervish and embarked on the path, I realized really and truly that all my bags of tricks, you know, that I had accumulated over all those years really could do nothing without that divine energy. That's the juice right there, you know. And it's kind of like, you know, that old saying that if you want to build a house, you can't take out a hammer and lay it on the floor. Somebody's got to pick it up and start to swing it, you know. Otherwise, it's just a dead tool laying on the floor. So all of those things, and the therapist herself is nothing but a hammer laying on that floor unless it's picked up by that energy of the divine and used. So I'm a tool. I'm not, you know, none of this, none of these techniques, none of these skills are of any use to anybody unless they are picked up by the hand of the divine and used to those purposes. And then they can be used to their maximum capacity. But in and of themselves, they're worthless, you know. And that connection to that divine energy is what makes the healing happen. Not anything else but that.
But you didn't know that before, or maybe you did know that before.
Maybe I might have had some kind of clue of it before, but I didn't know it in my bones the way I knew it after having lived through it. You know,
what was the thing that shifted you? What was that moment where you, you know, realized, I mean, yeah, you, but there was, must have been a moment where it's like, boom, this is your path, this is what you got to do, and this is what you have to share with the world.
Well, I don't know about what I have to share with the world, but I know
You're sharing it right now.
Well, it's more about like a series. I wouldn't say there was any one moment. There's a series. There's a lot of moments. You know, Effendi, our teacher, Muzaffar Effendi, used to call it the polishing, you know. So if you have a lamp, you know, and it's filled with tarnish and soot, it takes quite a lot of rubbing to get all of that soot off, so that way it can kind of shine through in all of its brilliance and luminosity. And each time that cloth rubs off a bit of the tarnish, you know, it's a little bit, that's a moment, you know, and sometimes it's painful and sometimes it's awesome and sometimes it's joyful, but, you know, each time is a moment. So there's many, 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 many moments that kind of lead to these realizations, you know.
What are some of the things that polish that cloth? What are some of the things that you did or other people?
I guess living in spiritual community has a lot to do with it, you know, because living in spiritual community, living with family, you know, it's about the way that people who love each other rub up against each other. I mean that in a kind of, you know, metaphorical way, of course. But, we kind of brush up against each other, that our limitations and our wounds and our the places that, you know, the shadows perhaps, they kind of rub up against each other. And when that happens, because of the love that holds you together, you have to look at it and accept it and open to others and to your own. It becomes a mirror for your own places that need to grow, you know. So, I mean, in a really tangible sense, you know, somebody, you know, you wake up one morning and your partner has had a bad night and is kind of, you know, snaps at you or something. Not that my partner ever does, because I'm married to an angel. But, you know, those kinds of ordinary, everyday things, that's a moment. That's a moment, because you look at that, and it might be a small little rub, but when you bring that awareness, okay, wow, that was hurtful, what she just said to me, you know, that hurt my feelings, but God, I love her, and I know that that comment or that exchange or that rubbing up against each other might say something to me about her. It might say something to me about myself, and I'm willing to open to that and hold that.
But was that something you learned from Sufism, or that's something you just always knew?
Yes, it's something that deepened through Sufism. So Sufism is something, living in close proximity, not just to your partner, but to a larger spiritual community, and recognizing that you're bound to each other through this common lineage, like a family is. And that, so often in our world and in our culture, we feel like relationships are expendable, and that they exist for our own satisfaction. And that's so not the case,
So through the Sufism work, before you did that work, you mean you would have just said, something not so nice.
Before I did that, I might have been like, well, what's wrong here and what's going on and, what needs to be fixed and maybe I need to communicate differently and maybe she did it. And there's still, of course, an element of that,
right.
Maybe I could communicate differently. Maybe there's something going on with this other person. But it's what's different now is that there's this underlying sense that despite all of that, it's just the nature of human relationship and that it doesn't necessarily mean that there's anything wrong with it. It can just be that rubbing away, that just comes from living every day. It doesn't mean that anything's got to be rewired or turned around.
Oh, so if you do something to bother somebody or they do something to bother you, mm-hmm. and if there's love, then you look at yourself and see, okay, what is it that you're attached to or you're holding on to or something like that? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's kind of like if there's love and, hopefully, I always look for the love. I try to always look for the love. The first thing is about recognizing that how important it is to suspend judgment, because judgment will get in the way of clear seeing, And then understanding that the love is at the basis, whether it's your partner or whether it's your service sister or brother or, whoever, that love is at the basis of the relationship and that, there's something to be gained from looking at what's happening, and it doesn't have to be necessarily always fixed or changed around. It can just be accepted and open to, and sometimes a lot of times that's painful, but it doesn't mean that there's something wrong because it's painful. Sometimes it just is,
And so that's how you look at everything, you're saying, as well, right?
Yeah,
and
ultimately, all of life is like that.
And that's how you get your clients to look at that as well. Is that sort of the position you take with your clients?
And hopefully, inshallah, that there are so many things, so much of, even if you look at the spirituality of the 12 steps, in the recovery movement and every facet of them, the first step is understanding that we're powerless, and powerless over what? We are not the ones who are calling the shots in this world or in our lives. There's a greater force here, a higher power, if you will, and we're powerless in a good sense. It's about surrendering that will, DBT, Marshall Linehan, in dialectical behavioral therapy, calls that willingness as opposed to willfulness. It's about giving up that need that the human being has to control circumstances, to control feelings, to control environment.
Yeah, each other. Each other, yes. We want to control. So
control each other, yeah. And once you give up, that's the surrender. You know, and once that happens, and you're able to truly give up, and this is a daily practice, you know, everything becomes easier, because then whatever the natural pain of life brings you doesn't turn into suffering. It's just pain instead of lingering agony.
Pain and blame. You don't blame someone for it either.
So blaming is that's a toxic thing, you know.
Well, that's what the world is made of. That's why people go to war. You did this, I'll do that. And so to transcend that, you have to kind of be spiritually aware. I mean, your reason you're doing this is because you know that you're bigger than the ego mind, if you want to call it that, right?
Well, no, it's kind of like the opposite, you know, of that, in that I'm the ego.
Yeah.
Is really nothing, you know, that's the illusion. Right. God is bigger than the ego mind, and that's ultimately who all of us are. You know, we're just, you know, these tiny little atoms in this one blazing sun of truth, which is God. That's all that each of us is.
So what's the purpose of this life? Why did we come in? What are we here to do?
Love. Love is the purpose.
But we were already love before coming in.
Well, you know, it's kind of like we were already love before. And Rumi says that, you know, with each incarnation, you become boiled a little more and a little more. And life, you know, cooks you. And the more you cook, the more delicious you become for this feast of divine love, this unending feast of divine love, which is what God is. You know, so we come into this life to become more delicious food for that feast.
So it's a process, you're saying,
the
right?
Process.
I mean, and you're in this process. Have you... What do you need to do to arrive at that place?
How would we what?
To arrive, to finally be totally cooked, you know? What do we do?
I don't know if anyone has completely ever arrived at it, you know? Maybe the very enlightened, you know, Jesus and Muhammad and, you know, Moses and Buddha and Krishna. Maybe these beings are beings who've arrived there. But I think the rest of us are continually cooking, you know. We're continually doing that. And what do you have to do in order to cook? You don't have to do anything. The divine is doing it for you. All you've got to do is say yes. All we can do is say yes. There's no other choice.
Is that the sort of approach you take with your clients? They come in with a problem, they're having a relationship problem, and you don't have to call it Sufism, but do you point that out at that kind of spiritual level, or do you not?
Not in that way. You know, it's kind of like, you know, as therapists, you know, we're taught that you have to start where the client is. You know, so if somebody comes in and they're in, you know, an abusive relationship, then of course I'm not going to sit there and say, well, yeah, say yes. And, you know, no, of course not. You know, this is kind of like, you know, I'm speaking on one level here, which is a very...
Right. No, I didn't mean like, of course you wouldn't, but I mean, it's right. Like the whole approach it seems like you're taking is to have people, you know, look at themselves, look at their behavior, right?
Yeah. I mean, on a very base level, like if you kind of peel away all the levels of that kind of work, that's ultimately what it boils down to. But, you know, there's different, you know, different levels that people are operating on all the time, you know. So there's a psychological level, and there's a social level, and there's a, you know, spiritual level. And so all of these things are happening simultaneously, you know. So to have to say to somebody who's coming in with a very, who's in a very kind of tangible place of conflict and emotional turmoil, and saying, you know, I'm constantly fighting with my husband or something, you know, and to see that on a basic level, that it all boils down to opening up and acceptance and everything. Is in order to get to that place, you need to be able to exist inside of some boundaries, and to set boundaries, and to, you know, be able to communicate in effective ways.
That's where your training comes in, and then once you feel like they're open, you can start to pull out these other more advanced spiritual concepts. Is that what you do?
Right, and that's exactly right. That's exactly it, Alan. And it kind of weaves through. It's not, you know, sometimes, you know, people come in and they want this, they're thirsty for it, you know, and they dive right into that end of the pool, so to speak. But other times people come in with real life, you know, tangible kinds of issues, and they're not interested in these deeper spiritual or philosophical.
Well, they're not interested, but it seems like that's your approach. You can't help it. So if they're not interested, then you must still talk to them on whatever level they can. How do you talk to those people?
Yeah, so I talk to them on whatever, like you said, on whatever level they want to be engaged with on. However, what makes the difference is that I'm still rooted in that, you know.
Right.
So as they're sharing whatever they're going through with me, I'm inwardly, you know, rooted in, you know, a certain kind of perspective. And that's something that they derive a sense of security and peace from, whether it's spoken or not. So we can talk about things on a very tangible level and talk about, you know, how do you set boundaries and how do you communicate and how do you, you know, advocate for yourself and these kinds of things. But if I'm, as the therapist, rooted in this perspective, in this truth, in this practice, then it comes through. And it doesn't come through in words. It comes through in the way that, you know, we hold the space together, you know. So,
no, it's exciting. It's exciting, the practice that you have. And I think, you know, it's part of this transformation that, and you're living it. It's your living experience. I mean, is there a certain practice you do, like a meditation or?
Yeah.
What
do
you do?
Yes, every day. And, you know, the one thing I do want to mention for other therapists out there who might be hearing this, is how powerful and important it is to pray for our clients, you know. Praying for our clients is so important, you know. Because it opens up the space. You're kind of crystallizing this intention and this love and this energy, you know, and bringing it into conscious awareness and putting it out into the universe for their benefit. You know, and sometimes that makes, I think, many times it makes just as much of a difference for them than anything we actually do in the session, you know. So praying for
them.
Well,
that's great.
I'm sorry.
No, what are you saying? You're doing what? No, tell me.
In doing a daily practice, it's so important. You know, the practices that I do are what's called Tesbi, and it's chanting and different kinds of prescribed prayers and recitations and contemplation and, you know, these different, the zikr, weekly weekly zikrs, which you've taken part in. You said that, you know, you did one with Sheikh Noor. God, I wish that I had the opportunity to do that. But you know what that is. It's kind of like a standing. Yeah.
Well, it's very blissful. The zikrs I did in Hawaii, we really would tap into something, you know, quite beyond this plane.
Was that with Sheikh Noor?
No, that was with Leila, part of the Mornadine tradition. You know Mornadine?
Oh.
Did you know him, Mornadine? I forgot what.
Mornadine.
I thought that was the Sufi Sam tradition. You know, Sufis. That was his.
Oh yes, Mornadine. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, that's.
And Shabda, Pir Shabda, Rouhaniyat.
Maybe, Rouhaniyat. And then there was this woman Leila who did some beautiful zikrs in Maui.
Oh, that's lovely. Oh wow.
Yeah, so Sufi Sam brought. And then I was also involved with I told you, Sidi Muhammad, that path. Mm-hmm. Robert Jaffe was there. I mean, I've run into Sufis, Adnan Zahan, beautiful Sufi dancer, comes to New York every year. He's a good friend of mine. He's an old friend. I've known him for
about
25
amazing.
Years.
Wow, Alan. So, you are a dervish. You know this from the inside out.
I guess I know parts of it. I also like Llewellyn Van Lee is brilliant.
Oh,
have you read his?
Yeah, no, he's.
Yeah.
So when are you going to come and see us again?
I do want to come down there. I want to talk to Sheikha Fariha, who's a beautiful woman who runs the zikrs down there. We'll stay in touch. But how can people find you?
Find the derga? Find,
yeah, well, to
find
your therapy, to talk to you, to become a client.
Oh,
to
sure. Yeah, so my website is authenticitypsychotherapy.com. And, you can just do a search for that or look up my name, Anne Marie Agosta, AGOSTA, on the internet, and you'll come across my website. And the our community is called the Noor Ashki Jarahi Sufi Order International. And our spiritual guide is Sheikha Fariha Al-Jarahi. And we're in Tribeca in New York City. And we have zikrs every Thursday night at 7:30. And everyone is welcome, whether you're traveling or, you live here. Just walk right in and, experience that bliss for yourself, because it's really an incredible, incredible blessing, as you know. So,
thank you, Anne-Marie, for taking
amazing.
The time. And so the best website, if people are interested in your work, is what again?
It's Authenticity, AUTHENTICITY, psychotherapy.com.
Great. Thanks for being a guest on the program.
Alan, thank you so much, really. It was really a lot of fun. As you said.
You see, it's
so
simple.
Much.
We just talked.
Yeah. It was great.
Yeah,
you're great. Thank you so much, Alan, really.
Thank,
I appreciate it.
Thank you. And, this is part of the ongoing series of spirituality and psychotherapy and how the two are merging in some ways. I think this is a great example of that merger. Thank you. I'll be in touch with you. Thanks again. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com. Email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thank you for listening tonight. Good night.